Welcome to the Localist Podcast, a podcast showcasing the local heroes of Pakistan.
People creating positive change and driving the country towards a better future.
I'm Mo.
I'm Rabia.
And we are the Localists.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Localist Podcast. Today on the show, we've got Namal Siddiqui. Namal and I first met while we worked together as advertising executives at JWT Dubai. She's since left the corporate world to explore her love for mountaineering, moving from Dubai to Islamabad earlier this year. She's summited various peaks in both Africa and Asia, most recently attempting a winter ascent of Zui Sar. I'm going to butcher that, but that's all right. She'll fix it later. Beyond this, Namal is a poetess and a spoken word performer who has been writing since she was a child, later publishing her work on her blog and social media. She has performed her work publicly at events such as the Emirates Literature Festival, Dubai Expo 2020, and the Global Citizen Festival. Namal, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mo. How are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. It's a pleasure to be here. And it's been...
Yeah, finally.
Yes, I know.
We've only tried to record this like 3 different times.
Yeah, I think I'm not going to count anymore.
Yeah. And as regular listeners might notice, we're missing a host, but that's okay. You know, this is an episode. It is happening. So Namal, I started off with this little intro where, like, we talked about us being advertisers. We talked about you being a mountaineer. We talked about you being a poetess. How did that come about? I mean, I want to like dig into the let's just start with you. Tell us a bit about yourself from your perspective.
Well, I was born and raised in the UAE, and that has been home for 33 years. You know, my entire family lived there. I went to school there. I went to university. I worked. I mean, everything that I did and experienced was in the UAE, and I don't know. I somehow fell into the advertising world, which is where we met.
I think we all fall into it. No one actually goes. Yes. Oh my God, I love ads.
I know.
No, wait, there are those people.
So that's the funny thing. So I started off in the banking industry. I did 3 years over there in HSBC, and then the recession hit all of us. And it was also a good time for me to realize that I didn't want to be in the banking industry. And I did start very early at the bank. So I was still 21 when we all were affected, and when I was affected. And then I realized that this is definitely not something I want to do. So I actually got a internship at BBDO where I was copywriting. And I realized I didn't want to do any sort of creative writing for money because it was really spoiling my writing process. And that's how I decided, no, I'm going to stick around in marketing, but I'm not going to do creative work. I'd like to keep that for myself. So I think in terms of keeping my poetry and really like saving it for myself was like the idea came from there. I did start writing really early in school. I began to write in school magazines and whatnot, just submit. And every year I would always see an entry, from my side. So I think that motivated me a lot. My English teachers were amazing. My Urdu teachers, my language teachers were amazing. And I really enjoyed those classes. And through time, I realized my mother is a writer as well. She writes poetry. And it all just sort of like became this interesting little pool of inspiration for me. Going back to marketing. So I didn't want to, touch this, my writing experience at all. So I said, okay, I'm going to stick to marketing where I can have some sort of creative access, but I also sort of like learn how to be in the game, you know, the business side of it. And that's how I moved through ad agencies and through e-commerce companies. That's what was happening those days. I was lucky to be part of that.
I like the fact that you said you were lucky to be a part of it. There's so many of us that that have served, especially in account management, that have served their time at ad agencies, and we come away from it so disgruntled and burnt out and stuff like that. And those things are true. They're 100% true. But I feel like there's an element to especially advertising account management, which just shows you how to better deal with and teach people. Sometimes I see people having interpersonal communication, and I'm like, wow, you guys really don't know how to communicate with each other. And I feel like, especially in a business environment, there's no better way to learn how to communicate with the person than that, or you turn into an email jockey, but whatever.
Yeah. Oh my God. I completely agree with you. I think it has really honed my skills in terms of communication. I don't know if I can say certain things, but you can be.
You can say whatever you want. It's all good.
Amazing. So you can.
We have no sponsors.
Okay. So we're free to say anything.
Just don't talk shit about Alex, because he'll be on the podcast.
Oh, dear Lord. Okay, fine. I'll try not to. You learn how to be bitchy, but by being nice. there's a lot of skills you learn.
How many times have you heard the term kill them with kindness?
Exactly.
Or some shit like that?
Exactly. But I think it's one of those jobs where you really sort of face the shitty end of a lot of people, not just the client, but also the creatives. But at the end of the day, it's in your hands how to sort of deal with the situation. But honestly, yes, I was disgruntled. I enjoyed it too. But there was a lot of frustration. And it was probably one of those things about, having a corporate career where I was just at some point in my life, I was like, okay, I need to do something else. I'm going in for a holiday, but I need to do something different. And one of the things that I realized was, and it's funny, I always tell the story. I realized I'd never broken a bone in all my years.
Dude, your life is such a parallel to mine. I'm sorry to cut you off, but it's just you grew up, you're Pakistani, you grew up outside of Pakistan in the Middle East. I mean, I grew up in other parts as well, but they're all kind of similar in that third culture kid respect.
Yeah.
And then you got burnt out in the ad agency. We even worked in the same place. That's how we know each other. And then you end up moving back to Pakistan, and you've never broken a bone in your body. This is just please tell me more how you are me.
Can you imagine that? And yeah, for me, it was okay, I haven't broken a bone. I haven't, and it wasn't I wanted to go and break a bone, but it was okay, I haven't done.
I'm sure I know people that can help you with that.
Yeah, I'm sure I've upset a lot of people in my life. Trust me, there's going to be.
You'll find a creative director.
Oh, dear Lord. They will be very happy to come and break it with their own hands. But yeah, it was okay, I need to do something different, something a little, I don't know, take a risk or something. I was in the middle of ad jobs, and I was looking up, I was part of an influencer agency. We were trying to say there was two people. And we're trying to set up an influencer agency. And Dubai influencers, a lot fashionistas and all those people. And I think I was...
Lifestyle, I think is the word.
Lifestyle, right. Yes. Okay. Fashionistas. It's pretty old, isn't it? I used to work at Namshi in the beginning, and that's what we used to use the term. But yeah, I mean, it was I think I was at a block. I couldn't think anymore. And I was what am I doing? Why? And you have to deal, with all due respect, to even influencers and the work that they do. It was just not my kind of thing. And I said, okay, you know what? Let me look for other kind of influencers, travel bloggers or whatever, something different. And I came across this Egyptian, he's you could call him an influencer, but he's a climber and he has gone, he's done all the seven summits of the world. He's gone to the North and the South Pole. He was also picked to go by NASA to be part of like, you know, a project, 30 people.
Oh, I know exactly who you're talking about. He's a triathlete as well, isn't he? I forgot his name, but
I don't know if he's
I know exactly. I know who you're talking about.
It's Omar Samra.
Like UN ambassador. Yes.
Omar Samra. Yeah. So, you know, I came across his profile and I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And I started looking him up. I came across interviews.
So you got influenced by an influencer.
Yeah, and he was a banker in the beginning of his career. As he was a banker, you know, he had some similar kind of thoughts. He went on a trip, and he's like, "Okay, I enjoy hiking, climbing, etc." And that was his journey. But I was looking at his interviews. I came across his late wife's interview as well, where she had this 9-to-5. It's interesting because when I saw her interview. And that's when I was like, oh my God, I needed to watch this because she had a 9-to-5 and one day she decided to go up a mountain for no reason. So parents are like, what, who does that? And nobody's going to marry you. And, you know, she instead decides and she goes and she meets her husband over there and, you know, it's, you know, kind of like a fairy tale as well. But to me, it was like, that's amazing. You know, she picked her bags and she left. And I think I needed that kind of trigger. And I said, you know what? And I needed that trigger from a woman as well. And I just did that. I remember I joined JWT the second time. And I actually right before that trip, I had gone to Mount Elbrus in Russia. And I'd made it to the top. So we had summited. And I came back on a complete high. So that was my first, and once I did that, I just couldn't get off the mountains. You know, it was something that I fell in love with. So for the past 5-6 years, it's been something that I do. It's been always a vacation. It's never been sort of a holiday, whatever you want to call it. I mean, I travel and I do a mountain, and that was the way I was like, I need to. This is how I'll cover the mountains around me. And poetry and mountains just sort of like happened, you know, in parallel. I continued. With poetry, I discovered a group, or the group discovered me. It's called the Poetry Hood, and he's a good friend of mine now, Jamil. He runs it.
They have a podcast, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And
I listened to your episode like when I was researching what to ask you. I'm like, yeah, I know her, but like, do I know her? Like, you know, so.
Yeah. So, I mean, you heard that. So yeah, I guess I know him for like what, 4 or 5 years as well now. And I never did spoken word. I always wrote and I posted. So he came across my Instagram profile somehow. And you know, we ended up speaking. I went for a workshop that he had conducted, and I realized, like, you know, reading out my poetry first, the first step is obviously sounds nice because you hear yourself, but, you know, you need to sort of like gain that confidence and that momentum. And you discover a different kind of writing as well when you start doing spoken word because you're hearing your voice and you hear rhythm. So it was a very beautiful journey. And I still get nervous when I do spoken word. Very, very nervous. But, you know, I love it. I enjoy doing it. The process of writing has changed for me with spoken
word. All right. Let's take a step back because you're like giving a very like comprehensive overall picture of all the things I wanted to kind of deep dive into.
Yes.
So the one thing we've got now is how you transitioned from corporate to to mountaineering, and like I get that, and I like that's something that when you said that, like that for me is so relevant because I like once again there's such a parallel here between you and me, whereas like I was at like my umpteenth agency and I was just like, completely burnt out, and like there's a certain part of me that felt disingenuous because I was just like, or like in, not disingenuous, inaccurate, I don't know, inauthentic is the word, because it was just like, what am I doing, you know, like, and I didn't want to share my creative energy with them. And for a while, you know, the way you got the mountaineering bug, I actually got like the CrossFit bug, a little more indoors. And I did that for a while, but even then, like that kind of felt kind of droned on. And I'm in the process of looking for that high right now. I will say, like, doing these podcasts makes me feel really good. So, you know, thanks for coming on. Let's take a step back. I want to delve into the poetry aspect a lot, because I am a huge appreciator of literature. I like to write myself. I have like books of poetry which have been lost in the several moves. Yeah, I guess the part that's slightly different between you and me is my dad was in different cities a lot in Saudi. So he'd get posted to one city, to, it was almost like an army kind of life, but it was an oil company instead. He was kind of in demand, I suppose, and he would get sent to different cities, and we'd end up moving house a lot. So every few years we were moving house, and I feel like some of my poetry books were lost in that. Like, I know recently, like, I think about 3 years ago, my parents came and dumped a giant box at my house. And, like, there was a lot of old stuff, like assignments from when I was 5 years old. And some of these poems are so dorky, but, like, I actually had more mature stuff, like, as in, not like adult content, but, like, I mean, like, mature as in, you know, like, I wrote it when I was probably in my teens and stuff, and it was more meaningful. And I was trying to, and I think I wrote it in an attempt to process something that I was going through at the time. And I wish I could find those, but I can't find those. I might have thrown them away intentionally so nobody found them, but who knows? I honestly don't remember at this stage. But as some, but I guess, way massive bird walk there, but as someone that like is really into this and stuff, I'm really, really curious as to how did you get into poetry? And I want you to, and this is something I'm stealing from the Poetry Hood podcast, is I'd love to hear about your first poem. If I remember correctly, it was about a candy bar.
Yes, it was. I have looked for it. Unfortunately, it was never digitized in any way. It was actually written, and I remember it was like in a green folder somewhere, tucked away like 4, 5, 6 houses ago. So I don't find it. I can't find it anymore. But it was, you know, it was so simple. It was like, you know how you say you were trying to process some kind of thought during your teenage years. I remember that was the first poem I wrote. We probably learned some kind of structure in school about poetry. And I came home and my parents just, you know, they came from out, you know, they had gone outside. They came and they brought like one of my favorite chocolates. And, you know, as a child, I felt so much happiness because my parents thought about me, you know, like that thought process, like, oh, that's so sweet. Then they picked the right kind of chocolate. So I ended up writing like a 4-liner I rhymed it up and stuff. And it's sad. I can't find it anymore. But yeah, it was that little thing that they did. And I wrote a poem out of it. And I realized that my form of expression, of appreciation, of trying to understand something that I'm feeling was through writing. Like I felt happy after writing and reading it as well. Like I felt good about it. And I think that realization happened earlier in my childhood, and which was good because it helped me navigate a lot of my thoughts. I was an angry little child. I'm a middle child. So it really helped me put down my thoughts into a place and sort of channel that energy as well. So initially, that's what happened. But I think in due time, I learned how to sort of, you know, write about different things. So obviously, when I got into high school, I learned how to write about love or like, you know, whatever, like teenage romance. Also, as a teenager, like you're saying, you know, we are going through a lot of change. There's a lot of whys. And I think in our society, a lot of times they tell you, don't ask why. You know, that was my way of like putting things down onto paper. And they were not shared always. Only my closest friends would know I write even. Like, I, my friends hadn't read anything until I was 20 or something. So, yeah.
That's crazy because, like, I found out about your poetry through, like, you didn't tell me about it as a person. Like, it wasn't like we were sitting there over lunch and you're like, hey, check out my poetry. No, I literally found your Instagram. Like, it was a recommended account for me because, like, oh, Nummel is in your network. Why don't you check out Nummel's poetry account? And I'm like, oh, let me check this out. And then, like, I saw, like, all kinds of things. That's really interesting. Like, and I think that's, you know, like everyone these days, you know, is trying to like optimize in some way. It's just like, oh, I've got to do this and I've got to do that. Like, how can I optimize my time? And then there's like that burnout element and everything. And that leads everyone back to journaling, right? Like, how many times have you heard about people, especially in the corporate world or whatever? Oh yeah, well, you know, I journal to like get my feelings out and, you know, therapists recommend it or whatever. And it feels like there's this element, like, I don't know about you, but a lot of the encouragement for me with my writing when I was younger came through school. Like, a lot of these half-assed poems I wrote when I was 5 are like, write your mom a Mother's Day poem. I don't know what the hell a poem was, but I wrote one, right? And they suck, but they're there. And that, and I feel like, you know, and there's, that was a constant. And then we used that to process our emotions or the things that we're going through or whatever. And I guess the thing is, you kept writing, whereas like, a lot of us just fell off. We're like, oh, we don't need to do this anymore. No one's grading this, so yeah. Let's not. And then years later, you're trying to find a system to like to process your emotions or whatever, and people are inevitably led back to writing. You know, that's really
– yeah.
I mean, that's one way. I'm just throwing that out there as a thought. You know, like, it's just something that occurred to me as you were speaking.
You're right. And I, like, for me, I think the one of the reasons that I pulled through with the whole writing thing was I enjoyed – languages as a kid, like English and Urdu for instance were always something enjoyable, like, because you learn a lot about the culture as well through the language. So obviously English literature, we had all these different books, we had poetry books that I'm very glad that we had in our school in the UAE at that time. My teacher was amazing, so I remember, like, I had a teacher crush on my English and literature language, English language and literature teacher, and I was just like obsessed with her, just with the way she spoke and the way she carried herself, and she was just so graceful. I really like loved it, and then she would always pick me and be like, "Okay, Namul, you read most part of the chapter," and I'd be like, "Oh yeah, I get to read in front of the class." So,
dude, you're me. You're so me. Like, this is my childhood.
and were you like part of the the one who read or did not?
No, I was the one who read, right?
Like, amazing. Like,
because I don't know how I picked it up, but I was told, like, at about 6th grade, I had this really influential teacher on my life because he was then my English lit teacher in 8th and 9th grade as well. So, yeah. Like, he just had a massive influence on my life. Gary Bletch, shout out to him. He used to pick me out to read. And around the 6th grade, he told me, he's like, I don't know how you picked it up, but I had certain, when I would read with certain intonations. Nice. And like, I would be very expressive. So it would carry, it wouldn't just be like, a lot of people would just read as if they're reading like an accounting ledger, yeah. You know? Whereas like, I would read with some sort of expression or expressiveness. So like, I was, you know, that became a theme. And I didn't realize it up until that point that I read differently than a lot of people in my class. A lot of people just, I guess it was a natural thing that I picked up. I honestly think it was from my mom. She used to read to me every night as a kid. And I think she naturally had that, or it was taught to her or something. So I think I might've picked it up. But that brings me to a really interesting segue. Unless you, wait, you look like you're about to say something.
I was just going to say, and like, you know, there I had one point, which was a little funny story. But before that, when you mentioned your mom, I think like it is so important for us to read to our kids and still keep that like analog world alive somehow, because those kind of things really make a huge difference in the child's life. Like, I have nieces and nephews, and I take them to my poetry events, or we actually sit and practice writing poems, like, you know, with my 5-year-old, I'll tell her like, okay, you like this? All right. What do you like about it? So, and she'll end up making a little poem out of it. And in that process, she learns how to express herself. And I think like, it's such a lovely thing, like writing even letters to each other. Like I want to use words everywhere. And that's where I was going to get to. I love words. So reading, writing for me was always like the top priority. And one of the things while I was growing up, I wanted to be when I grew, you know, was be a newscaster when I'm older. And
I wanted to be a journalist. So once again, this is getting kind of close.
In that field, somehow at some point I wanted to be a war reporter.
Yes, exactly.
So all those kind of things. And I used to like imagine I'm going to be in, during those days, it was, I'm going to go to Afghanistan. I'm going to report everything that's going on over there. And with the newscaster thing, what happened was that I wanted to read news, and I loved the way those men and women would sort of enunciate everything, and you know, in such speed, but they're also delivering the message right. So I would practice.
But there's also like
So we had this corner where we had our laundry corner, and I had this washing machine against a wall, and I would go and, you know, that was a corner nobody would come to. So I would take the newspaper of the day and I would like sit against it towards the wall and just read out the news to a wall as if, you know, I'm being
recorded. Man.
And I used to go do that so much, like for an hour or two at one stretch, that I think reading became like a habit of mine. And I remember my uncle used to live with us those days, and he'd come and like, he'd stand behind me. I wouldn't know where he's standing. He's like, oh, really? Oh, right there you go. And then I turn around, oh my God, this is the most embarrassing thing in the world. But yeah, I think that's how this whole, like, I kept writing because I wanted to be linked to writing and putting my opinion out there somehow. If it wasn't through being a journalist, then I'd do it through poetry or some form of writing. So, yeah.
What I found constricting about journalism is like the point where I kind of finally like gave up on it. And that's funny because here I am like self-publishing a podcast, which in a way is journalism.
Yep.
But I remember taking a journalism class in 12th grade, my final year of high school. And we had this wonderful literature. She was my AP literature teacher. She was also my journalism teacher. Leanda Wood, awesome teacher.
Where did you go to school?
I went to a bunch of different schools The journalism class was in Saudi Arabia at Dahran High School.
Amazing.
So, class of 2005. I wonder if any of those guys listen to this podcast, and I do because one of them was a guest. S and Saya was on a few months ago, and he actually lives in Karachi now. Crazy small world. But what were they talking about? The journalism class,
yes.
Right? And Mrs. Wood, before she was a literature teacher, was actually a journalist in Australia, and she taught us how she made us work as if we were in a newspaper. So, like, we had to work by those guidelines. We had to write according to, like, we were given like certain. Some days somebody would be given a cover story for the school newspaper. Other months somebody would be given like a small thing, and you would be forced to write to those exact proportions, exact word limits. You'd have to come, your titles could only be a certain way. And when I found out how restricting that was to like the creative process, I gave up on it. I was just like, this isn't for me.
Yeah. I didn't want to continue copywriting, within the world. I think it makes sense. Completely.
Yeah.
I think with due time, and I'm glad that I didn't end up being a journalist is because I learned different forms of poetry myself, and as I grew older I became less of a political person. Like it's not something that I appreciate the way it happens in the world now. So, you know, I think...
You mean journalism?
Politics, because obviously, you know... That was my interest, like how, you know, war crime and whatnot. And I think like it was... for me,
I don't know if the politics have changed. I feel like it's the way we cover it, people cover it as journalists.
Yeah, it hasn't.
And I feel that's not very healthy right now, which is why that's the whole reason this podcast exists. Like Robbie and I created it as a response to that. We're just like the wrong people are getting getting the wrong space on the wrong platforms. I mean, admittedly, our platform's not huge, but we wanted to give the right people the right, you know, place to speak.
100%, and I think like for me it was through poetry I was able to express it better, mm-hmm. rather than trying to like make a point that had to be limited or restricted in some way or the other, you know. So
getting back to poetry a little bit, who inspires you as a poetess?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Like, I mean, I can take the names of a lot of artists and poets, but for me, inspiration is, I mean, I would take the liberty of fixing the who over there, because for me, it's like who and what around me inspires. I think the way I write is I write a lot about daily life. So if you look at the stuff that I've written, it's about elevator, traffic, traffic jam.
The IKEA poem comes to mind.
The IKEA poem, exactly. So it's like, you know, I was walking around in IKEA and I just like suddenly it struck upon me that everyone's sort of like enacting a life that they're going to live with this furniture. And so all the ideas suddenly came, and I looked like a creepo walking around. Like, I'm like, let me note this down. Oh, look at these people. Okay, this is what they're probably enacting, and blah blah blah. So it's always about very like a day to day, so for me it's the daily in the life, and then I go into more of like, why? What are we doing here? More of like the existential crisis that a human being has. And I'm always asking that question. And I think I'm always like sort of like fluctuating between this and that. But in terms of poetry and who inspires me, I think I have to say it's my mother, who was really like, I discovered her poems late in life. And when I did, I was like, oh my God, we are so alike. Just in terms of how and what she writes about. And she writes a lot about her daily struggles in life. And then she goes far to like extremely existential questions, but it's all in Urdu. And you know, her Urdu is like beautiful.
You've branched out into Urdu recently.
I do write in Urdu sometimes, but I don't share it because I'm like, yeah, no, there's gonna people gonna be laughing at this. But I always send it to my mom now. I'm like, what do you think of this? But now that I'm in Pakistan, I think I hear a lot of Urdu, and I start thinking a lot in Urdu as well, because that's one of the things I think in English. That process also kind of got messed up when I got here, because I was talking a lot in Urdu, a lot more in Urdu in Pakistan. So I was trying to like sort of meet halfway somewhere. Then the Urdu stuff came. I was like, I need to let the Urdu out. It needs to come out. Whether it's nice, it's good or bad, it needs to come out. So yeah, I mean, inspiration wise, I will say it's the people around me. You know, I had a good friend of mine was going through something, and I was so affected by it because we're close, that I wrote about it. So that's my inspiration. Things need to be frustrating in some way or touch me in some way or the other, that influences me.
So, all right, let me reframe this a little bit. Do you have a favorite, or do you have a favorite poet? Or poetess?
Favorite poet or poetess? Let's see. you know, in the classics, I will always go for the ones that I studied in school, because they kind of like put the whole, because we were studying the structure of poetry, Robert Frost and William Wordsworth and these.
Frost.
You know, I mean, Daffodils, like, I remember those poems.
I had to memorize Two Roads Diverged
exactly.
In high school. And thanks, Mr. Bletch.
Isn't that a beautiful poem? Like, it's lovely. Like, it really, like, that poem really formed the basis of a lot of things. Can you hear the tractor behind me? Sorry about that.
I'm good.
So, yeah, classic poetry, definitely these guys. Modern poetry, there's so many, I can't even think about it, but I'm forgetting her name. Her name is Mary, oh my God, what's her name? You got to cut this part out more. One second.
I don't edit. I haven't learned that yet.
Gosh, what's her name? I'm forgetting it. Mary. Ugh. Mary Oliver.
All right.
Yes, Mary Oliver.
Okay.
Mary Oliver.
Awesome.
She writes, okay, why I like her, she passed away, I think, last year. Why I like her poetry is she writes about nature a lot. Like, she'll write about the woods and the wild and the forest, and then she relates it with, like, human nature and how, the wild environment is similar to the nature of man somehow, and then she relates that, mm-hmm. and she makes those parallels. So I love the way she writes, and yeah, I think she definitely has to be somebody I would love to write like at some point.
For me, like, it was always Langston Hughes.
Okay.
Because I've always had that, like, revolutionary streak.
Love
like
it.
I've always like, fuck the world, let's change it, yes. kind of situation. And, you know, it comes through so, like, he does it so eloquently. Like, it's just, like, not F the world. It's more like, it's just so much better than that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he was cool. I remember that. And I think my proudest moment was, there was a point in time where, and this is, what's it called? I want to ask about this. This is a good segue. There was a point in time where I got enough courage to publish one of my poems. And when I say publish, I mean, like, literally posted on DeviantArt. If you remember that website, I don't know if people still use it.
No. Excuse me.
But it's all good. So I put one of my poems up on DeviantArt, and somebody read
DeviantArt.
It and they'd noted, and they actually, without prompting, had, I remember this comment. I don't think that comment exists. I don't think my poem is still live there. My account is dead. But somebody, without prompting or without any knowledge of who I was, had compared what I'd written to Langston Hughes. And I was like, oh shit. I was just like, so that's like, I unconsciously, like, I mean, I love the guy, I love his work, but like, it was just a crazy moment for me. I don't know. But
nice.
But that's where I'm coming to. And this is what I wanted to talk to you about, is like, there was a point where, like, despite stuff like little encouragement like that, there was a point where, cause I fell out of, like, writing poetry or writing at all, other than like an email, a sternly worded email to a client. We will push back on this deadline. Other than stuff like that, I kind of stopped writing. And when I got back into it, or when I wanted to again, I was always fearful of publishing it online, and or like other people seeing that work. Like, what are my friends going to think of me? You know, or what is the world going to think of me? Even if I do it under a pseudonym. Yet to me, I find this so inspiring about you, is like, I don't, and I'm sure, like, it's far from the case, or I don't know, you tell me how it is, but like, it's, to me, it seems, what you do seems fearless. Like, some of it is very personal, you know, and like, you are, and even beyond that, I've seen some of your online, I've seen some of your spoken word performances, because you are also a spoken word performer, and it you are so, like, it, to me, it's very brave, it's very, you're in a very vulnerable space when you do that. And I want you to speak to that a little bit. How do you do it?
Yeah. No. Thank you.
And what advice would you offer?
Yeah. Thank you.
Asking for a friend.
Sure. I'll. I think I know that friend of yours. So, the first time I put my poetry out, was when I was in my, you know, I don't know, I think I was 17, 18. And everybody started putting blogs on at that time. And I hadn't told anybody. So like blogging was a new thing. Everybody was blogging. And I remember I called it Notions of Identity. So I put that up there and then I left it. I would just post over there. And I realized it was getting a lot of readings and viewings from the States.
Oh, man, I remember this, actually.
Yeah, so that happened. And then I was like, okay, so people do read stuff. All right. But that like, you know, I think it was just that step, like, some things in my life that happened where I get an idea and I'm like, okay, you know what? I have to do it. And I put a deadline to it, like even moving to Pakistan, for instance. So that was that with sharing poetry. I was like, you know what? This is something I do. I need to put it somewhere. I'm always shy that my friends will read something, especially at that time. So that's why I never told anybody. But when I saw that, you know, people are starting to read across the you know, from in another part of the world, I said, okay, so people do read and people are interested. And I was getting really nice comments that eventually like turned into an, you know, Instagram took over. And then I was like, okay, I'm just going to stick to one medium. But this whole process of sharing, it's like, even as a writer, there's a lot of things that I write and I will not put them out in the world. So when I'm sharing something, you know, it's only when I have sort of like given that piece away. It's like that, like where I'm unattached to it. Because, you know, as a creative person, and you probably know this from the you yourself being creative and from the ad world that we belonged to, creatives are very, you know, obviously they get really personal about their work, right? They get you can't offend them all the time, or you can't really point too many fingers. So for me, it's like that also, and I get that sentiment. When I write a piece, I've probably felt very close, like very strongly about that topic. So I don't always share it with the rest of the world. Because I'm still quite sensitive about it. I still feel like, you know, if someone says something about it, I'll be like, oh, no, but, you know, excuse me, number 1, 2, 3. So I don't let it out. I let it sit. I will probably read it out, you know, a few times to myself, only when I'm comfortable in sharing and when I think that, okay, this will deliver itself nicely. And when I'm not affected by it, When I say give that piece away, literally I give that piece away. Then I record it, then I put it out in the world. So it's, yeah, it is. And it is really nerve-wracking also when you're standing in front of a large audience and reading your piece out, because you can be presenting something which is work-related, but it's not personal, right? But when it comes to like your own words, it's a very vulnerable situation because you're saying things that you have felt and you're, you know, there's like people listening to you. They could laugh or they could be like, oh, my God. So it is a tricky situation. But I think it's when you deliver, when you share, like I remember reading Elevator People, which I actually wrote about JWT and S5th and the elevator that we used to take to the 50s.
Oh, man, that.
Yeah. So it is a lot of it is mockery as well. Like it's funny. It is a serious topic, but it's also funny. So when I shared
it, satirical.
Yes. And when I shared it, people laughed. And yeah. That energy that we shared in that moment when people enjoyed the poem, that was so rewarding. And I think that's what makes you keep coming back, and that's what makes you want to write more or like share with people, because they actually understand the sentiment. So that's what I enjoy, I guess.
So leading on from that, what is there any advice that you'd offer to people that want to get started with writing or publishing their own, self-publishing, of course, or young poets or anything like that?
Yeah, I'm in the process of self-publishing. Like I've put down 2 books, so I would love for people to give me advice. but what I would say, at least about writing, is because that's the first step. just write, you know. It's like I would force myself to write when I had a ritual in the UAE. I would go on Saturday mornings, that was my morning, and sit for a few hours, have my cup of coffee. I would sit alone and I would just watch around me and I would just write. Now, I didn't have any particular topic in my head, but I would observe what is around me. And I think writing and poetry is a lot about observing what is around you, observing what is inside you. So anything that you're feeling as well is so important. You have to put it down into words. So anything. So the idea is to make that sort of a ritual. Sometimes I would take a word and write about it. So let's say I've written this and a really nice poem came out of it. It's called Green. And I just didn't know what to do. I wanted to write. And a friend of mine was actually making a video of me while writing. And she was like, I just want you to be writing and just write whatever. But you know, and I was like, it doesn't make sense if I write gibberish, because she'll record the video and she'll see it and you can see it. So I thought,
Lorem Ipsum, or the, exactly. The brown fox.
I can't do that, foxtrot. Yeah. Yes. So I the wall in front of me was green in color, and that was the first thing. I was like, you know what, let's think about all the green things in the world. And it turned out to be such a beautiful poem, because I, you know, when you think about the color green, and you know you go back to like the uniform that I used to wear in school, to the green sweater that I bought my ex, to, you know, like there are so many green things around you. And I just started thinking about it and writing them down, and it turned out to be a lovely poem. And I think it's one of my best, like if I think about the UAE, it's probably one of the best dedications I could give the country, you know, because it goes from like from my childhood memories to my adult memories to like it goes in all sort of directions. So yeah, just write, honestly, just write about anything and everything. Practice, that's what's important.
So going back to something you said a lot earlier, you spoke about the analog.
Yeah.
And like how important you felt the analog was, and you know, and I'm guessing the feel of like a nice worn old book in your hands or whatever. What is a book what is a book that you have frequently gifted to people? I'm stealing this from Tim Ferriss, who's my favorite podcaster, but what is a book you have frequently gifted to people or think that people should read?
I think what people should read, and I love this book. I think it changed the way I look at history in general, and it's about writing, and it's about the history of writing, but it really changed the way I look at how we've been recording our lives. And it's called The Literary World by Martin Buchner. And I hope I'm saying his name right. It basically goes back to the time and age when the first word or the first sort of like communication of any form was recorded. I think like it goes through this whole process of, you know, obviously people used to exchange verbally, and then how they started putting like fundamental texts came around first, right? So this entire like history, and he actually wrote this book over a span of 30 years. His research was for 30 years, because that's how far he had to go, obviously, like from like discovering paper in Japan, parchment paper, to et cetera, all the kind of technologies. So it really gives you a great lesson of history in terms of writing, in terms of thought process, and those days, how the society used to operate, like who's writing and who's recording, you know, who's got the job. Like at that time, you know, a scribe would sit and record history. And now look at us, right? We have phones in our hands and we type away anything. So I think it's a beautiful perspective to have in terms of how, you know, fundamental texts came through, how poetry came through, how women were recording their information, how men were recording. So, yeah, anybody who loves words.
Is there, so if we send people to go stalk you on the interwebs and find your poetry, what is there a particular piece that you'd like to direct them to?
Ooh, I think the one that I'm feeling a lot these days, and it's like the probably the I'd say the kind of like the highlight of my life, or the streak in my life, and it will always remain that, is Third Culture Kid.
Okay.
And I'm sure you would relate with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I love that one.
Yeah. And it's funny because, like, I wrote it while I was in the UAE, and now that I come here to Pakistan, which is the country of my passport, I feel it even more. Like it's it still remains the same. So I think it's,
You're a burger now.
oh my God, don't call me.
I'm so tired of hearing that. Like, next person that calls me a burger is gonna get punched.
I actually like had an argument with somebody. I was like, you cannot apply that to me because I didn't live here. So the burger thing doesn't apply to me. You cannot.
Yeah, is it? I feel like we need like an. I wish Rabia were here right now, who's somebody who was born and raised in Pakistan. But like, I thought it was people that left and came back, right?
No.
And then they were, but like, if you were always outside, and then you, I don't know if that counts anymore, right? Like,
Doesn't.
this is.
I'm sorry, it doesn't. This whole burger application, like, oh, your burger doesn't apply. And I've, anyway.
You know what? I'm okay with it as long as it's some lighthearted whatever. But the thing, my problem is, and I'm getting all serious now, is that it's often used to dismiss people's opinions.
Exactly.
And that's what bothers me. It's like, you wouldn't understand, you're a burger. And I'm like, no, wait, hold up. I understand it differently, and maybe that's actually a strength. Maybe we need to look at that
Yeah.
lens.
I think my exactly the issue is that the connotation is negative, but it's not. I mean, let's say there is a person who is called who is Burger, and they were born into that life. Like they were born, they were able to go to an English medium school, and they had a different kind of lifestyle in Pakistan. But like, I mean, why is that a bad thing? You know, if being I just don't get it. Like, oh my God, I'm gonna get into like, this is gonna be a different tangent.
No, let's do it. I'm feeling it. Like, there's something I want to say too, but let's I think we're going the same direction with this,
Yeah,
so.
so I think it's just, it's this thing that, like you said, dismissing things, and the issue is that we I think, and that, and obviously it's Pakistan related, we believe that it's because you were born into a specific space, you don't understand this, and I understand it better. But I don't think that's the case. People have different perspectives, and at some point when I started accepting the burger, like, when I was like, okay, you know what, I will be burger, fine. What's the issue? Now tell me. Now I can still continue speaking. I accept that I'm a burger. I'll continue speaking over what I am. Let's have that conversation. But yeah, I think there's a whole, I don't know if I want to dive into it, but
It's all about perspective, right? And
yes.
this I'm glad you said that word, because that was the thing that was on the top of my mind, is that I feel like there's a lack of understanding of different perspectives here. People like And I maybe and you know I'm sure this is other places as well, but I feel like there was and you know maybe this is one of the strengths of the advertising corporate culture, is it was a very collaborative culture. People were happy to hear other people's viewpoints most of the time. You know what I'm saying? We'd argue about it, but eventually it would lead to a better product or a better service or a better campaign. I think is the best way to say it. But over here, like, one of the things I immediately noticed is that, along with being dismissed as a burger, it wasn't just the burgers. It's everyone that doesn't share your viewpoint is dismissed
Yes.
because you wouldn't understand, rather than, well, let me talk to this person. They may be able to offer a fresh perspective on the same thing that I'm looking at.
100%. I think, and as they say, like, there's cliques over here. So you form those opinionated group of friends, I guess. And I think, like, yeah, you said a very beautiful thing about the advertising world, is that it is at the end of the day collaborative. I mean, the business director could be completely in disagreement about something, but eventually we'd always come down to a place where this person's good, this person's good, because at the end of the day, the product is for the people. It's not for one person. And I think that's a beautiful perspective that you gave there. Like, yeah, I'm not going to add anything to that.
All right. Well, I think we've spent a lot of time on advertising. We've spent a lot of time on your poetry, but that's by design. I really, really, really wanted to hear about your writing and your process and what goes on inside your head. Because it's helpful to me with what I'm doing right now with this podcast and a few other things I have planned with this localist adventure.
Mohawk.
So to speak. Yeah. let's talk about, you are now, one of the things you're doing, and we've touched on this, we now know why you're doing it, is you are also doing a lot of mountaineering. Take us through that a little bit. What are you up to these days?
Yeah, so I think like, I've been mountaineering for 5-6 years. As I told you, I discovered it, the story, and then I kept it at it every year. I said, you know what? Every year I'm gonna do a mountain. I'm gonna attempt one. I'm gonna do whatever it is, and I did that. I always, through time, I've worked for like 14 years of my life. I started early. I was 19, whatever. Even before that, we were doing a lot of like jobs here and there. Me and my older sister. So I wanted to take a break. I knew that I was never always going to be working for somebody. And I think the more I did that in the past few years, the more I realized that I'd like to do something on my own, by myself, or like have a different sort of career. And I think, so last year I did something crazy. It was literally October, when, you know, this thought came again, very spontaneous, but obviously it was in the making for many years in my head, was I wanna get up and experience different things. And I think the year that we spent with Corona at our homes really added to the weight of that. Like, you know, I was working for a tech company, and I was completely home, you know, in the house, doing all my meetings, doing really well. Like, you know, everything happened perfectly. I didn't have to go out for a single thing, but work just happened. And I realized, like, I'm spending so much time, like I'm spending way more time doing this. I think when you're in the environment of your house, you start noticing everything else within the house, because you don't spend that much time in the house if you think about it. But, you know, I was looking at the way our, you know, living room was set. Like, I hated the couch suddenly. I was like, this is such an uncomfortable space. Like, how could I bring this couch in the house? Why did I buy it? And like everything, you know, the hair that would fall on the floor, and I became a clean freak. So I realized, like, okay, you know, how do we change when we change our environment? And it was this trigger. Like in October, I said, you know what, I think I'm done. I'm gonna pack my bags and I'm gonna leave. And what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna go and explore mountains. And where could I do that possibly during Corona times? You know, with my passport, I said, I have a Pakistani passport, and Pakistan is a place where all the three big mountain ranges of the world are. So why would I not be there? And my parents actually decided to move. They retired and they moved to the States. So when they did that, for me, it was like, okay, I don't really have an anchor over here anymore. And that was my trigger, my parents moving out of the country. And I said, you know what, let's get up and go. So I gave myself 31st of December as a date and as a deadline. And exactly on the 27th of December, which was my 33rd birthday, it was such a weird, like, you know, it was like 33 years coming into a circle. And I left Dubai. And I've been here. I have explored and learned a lot. I based myself out of Islamabad, so I could actually sit and work from here. You know, I freelance, I do some content copywriting, I do some brand consultation, and that I do on my own terms. And then when I want to, and when it's the right time, I go and I've been taking trainings when it comes to mountaineering and climbing. So what I'm trying to do is really get better at the skills, the techniques, because there's one thing, which is, you know, you trek, but you also need to be very technical. The mountains in Pakistan are extremely technical. Like, you cannot always walk on your 2 feet. You need to be on all your fours, and you need to be roped in. You need to be like climbing, hanging from stuff. So yeah, I attempted Zui Sar, which is an unclimbed mountain, in the month of March, which was a beautiful experience. It was extremely cold. We were waist deep in snow, and when we decided to turn around, and then now recently I went to a place called Nagar, which has a mountain called Rush Peak, which is 5,100 meters. You basically are able to see like all the major mountains around you, including K2. So I made it to the top over there. It was amazing. I did it in 15 hours. Which was something crazy we did. So yeah, things like those, but it's been amazing. Like, you know, I think always what the mountain always teaches me is it's the mountains that rope me in to do all these adventures. But what I learn is the people, you know, from those places. They are the most beautiful people in the world. And I think, like, especially Nagar, I fell in love with it. The people were so inviting. I felt like I didn't feel like I was visiting or was in an alien place. Like, it was just the abundance that the people have over there, whether it's fertile soil, whether it's just, you know, they just have the biggest hearts. And you know, for me, it's a whole cultural experience as well, being here in Pakistan, and a very different Pakistan. Like, the food is very different. So yeah.
Just let that sink in. Think about that. We're going to talk about that in about 2 years or 3 years time, you and I, because what's it called? I'm 2 years ahead of you on this Pakistan experience situation. And what's it called? There's a lot about your mindset and how you view the rest of the world. And I think it's a good thing, and it's going to change. And I think we're seeing a reflection of that throughout the world in the media as well. But I think it's stronger. It's when you sit in the UAE and it's a very like multicultural environment, you get one version of it. When you sit here where there's that post-colonial influence, I think it's probably more prevalent in Karachi than Islamabad, but like you take that in and your perspectives start to shift. Like, this comes to like, who's writing what you're reading, and how did they feel about who's creating the products that you consume, and what was in the back of their mind, you know? And like, all these perspectives are going to start to shift. At least they did for me. And I think we have very similar mindsets, and I'd be very curious I'm definitely going to check in with you about that in 2 years, or maybe you're just going to message me one of these days and be like, I know what you're talking about. I got it. So
I have to add something to that. What you said about how we have this multicultural experience in the UAE, which is true. And I think that's why when I traveled around the world, I never had like a crazy culture shock, right? Like, it was always, okay, right, I've met these people before, you know, in another small environment. And that was nice. But it's crazy, right? Like, Pakistan is such a big place. And then there is this like a prevalent culture here, but you still have so much diversity within that. You know, you have all of the four different provinces, and then you have, even inside that, you have all kinds of people. Like, in Islamabad, I've met all kinds of people. In Karachi, we have, you know, like a lot of my own relatives are very different from how I am or how my friends are. There's so much diversity within this one prevalent culture. It's you really want to think about how you're conducting yourself and how anything that you say makes a difference, and how you say. I think for me,
how it's perceived.
Exactly, there you go. How it's perceived. And I think one of the things that I've learned here is how to deliver a message. And I'm saying that as a poet, but it's really interesting after arriving here. And like spending 6 months, you know, people will perceive, you know, people within the same vicinity will perceive like one message in so many different ways. But yeah.
No, I get that because like we, with this podcast, for example, there's a few other Pakistani podcasts that I listen to just to keep, you know, abreast of like, some of them I like, some of them not so much. Some of them have interesting episodes, but when I've spoken to some people that listen to our podcast in particular, I found out that because of how our message is delivered, it's a completely different set of people. Those people don't really care so much about you. I would think that, you know, like podcasting, especially in Pakistan, where podcasting is a very limited space. Mm-hmm. People care much more about visual mediums. Then audio hasn't caught on as much here.
Yeah.
But like, what's it called? And then we are at this stage audio only, unlike a few other podcasts that I know of. But like, you would think that because the audio space is so limited, it takes a certain type of person to appreciate what a podcast is. And then that type of person is already so limited of a niche that all of them are probably going to be listening to all of them. But then what I found out is, no, not at all. Even within that limited niche, and also like a limited niche in Pakistan, because this such a populous country, is like the entire population of the UAE, right? Like,
yes.
That's what's ridiculous. But yeah, like those within that limited niche, there's another limited sub niche that wants to listen, that is going to listen to what you have to say. It's something that we've learned by listening to our audience as we've been doing the podcast.
And I think like, one of my questions for you is, after you say mm-hmm. this, and you asked me about my piece that people would want to read, it's Third Culture Kid, and you guys are the localists. So tell me, what do you feel about being a third culture kid? Like, I'm interested to know that.
Oh, my God. I think it comes with a lot of advantages. I'm going to start with the good, because that's what's coming readily to mind, is no matter where I go in the world, I come with a unique perspective. And I've seen this across the board with other, you know, third culture kids, is that it's more balanced, our perspective, because I think we've had more exposure. We don't lean to any particular thing, towards any particular direction. And I think we can come up with a lot cooler. I mean, not cooler, but like it's unique. I think it's an identity on its own. And I think this is something I've come to terms with only recently. I'm still struggling with this. Is that it's, man, we should get the Dakan Show guys on here as well. Just like, their entire thing is based on this principle. The entire, like, that search for identity.
Yeah.
It's what led me here. It's what led me away. It's what brought me back. It's just, I feel like this is the bad part, I suppose. There's this constant search for identity, for belonging, for purpose even. And I feel it's harder for us because we are the product of so many different things, and you're always going to be pulled. And so to me, I always get pulled in so many different directions. It's difficult to maintain that, to create a focus or to find that. And I'm still searching for it. And, you know, maybe it's not so much something that we'll ever find, but something that'll define the journey that we go on the rest of our lives.
Amazing. The reason I ask is because I feel so strongly about it. I, again, same position as you. I'm here, I'm there. You know, I'm kind of like in that initial process of when you moved around. And I think like this need for identity or like belonging somewhere, it's interesting. Like, you know, the way the world is going, a lot of us will be third culture kids eventually. And like, imagine, I mean, if I have kids, I don't know what culture will they be, will they belong to? Because, you know, I'm not completely Pakistani in my head, or I'm not completely Arab in my head. So, right. And I think like that's where the world is going to. So what does it mean Like, you know, what does identity mean exactly? Or like, do we really need to find, like, is it really a search that we need to be out for? But I think it's, I mean, it's a long-term process. Like it's our mindsets. We're always looking for roots somewhere. And do we,
I think that's human in a way.
Yeah, it is human. But like with the way the world is going now, what does that mean? I might be wrong in thinking this way, but and there is no right answer. But like, do we need roots, should we be looking for roots?
This is like buying a record versus getting a Spotify subscription. This is what this is. I get that, and you know, I felt that, you know, in my life I've anchored myself to people rather than places.
Yes. Very nice. Beautiful.
But something that I just want to go back a little bit, like we were talking about burgers, not the type you can eat, but well, cannibalism is a thing, but what's it called? Do you think, and this is just a thought that occurred to me throughout our conversation, do you think calling someone a burger is the local way of, or Pakistan's way of identifying a third culture kid to a certain extent? Maybe it's something that to them, because where we came in Saudi and Qatar and the UAE, the places I've lived, this is the norm. Most of us are third culture kids, the expat population at least. Over here, it's more of a rarity, and I feel like they struggle to define you. You're a Pakistani, you should have more of this, but you don't, so we're going to label you something else.
I and the Pakistanis who've lived here all their lives may correct me, but I personally...
Yeah, we're missing that person right now. But,
yeah. And I think I don't think it is about being a third culture kid. I think it's... and maybe in some way it is, but I think it's a lot about also social status, because that's a real big thing over here.
Jesus,
you know,
yeah.
And
for as materialistic as people call the UAE, the difference, it's a different type here, isn't it? Like,
it's because so I came across someone else said, no, I'm not burger, I'm bun kebab. You know? So it's kind of like defining, right? Like it's the defining what the affordability of, obviously a bun kebab, you know, you'll find it for 100 rupees, but a burger you'll eat, you know, you'll have to spend at least 500 rupees on a burger. So I really feel like it's about social status. It's the kind of school that you can afford. English medium schools are more expensive. So for me, that's what it is. And somebody who can speak English, like English is such a big deal. If you can speak English better.
You have an accent. I'll say it openly. Yeah. There were doors open to me and opportunities that were given to me when I came that would not have been given to people, other people, simply because of the way I spoke.
Totally. So I think that topic will require you to do it needs a dedicated show.
Yeah, no.
But yeah, in short, like I think it's social status, what people are referring to when they call somebody burger and bun kebab. And I don't know if there's a rap or something else.
There's a poem in there somewhere.
Nice.
Namal, is there anything else you'd like to add here? Is there a parting... I think we could wrap up, unless there's something else you want to talk about here.
Oh no, I think it's been lovely talking to you. I think we talked about a lot of things. We talked about poetry, about mountaineering, about moving here, and also getting to know you as well and like your love for poetry. And I hope that you do share some work of yours. I mean, even if it's like from your teenage days. It's just always interesting.
I'd be more interested if I could find the teenage stuff. I'd be inclined to share it. I thought it was. I remember it being pretty good. The elementary days, which is not good. That's not good.
That's fine. Like I think it's always not as refined as our thoughts. Like you know, now we're able to
I mean, you're five.
Create
basic motor skills are an issue.
Yeah, but now we're able to at this age. I think we're able to build a nice facade. for somebody to think that this looks nice. But I think during a teenager's, the thoughts are very raw. Like, I would love to exchange some poetry.
Yeah.
We could do that. We can exchange poetry from our teenage.
Sounds good.
But,
Nubbles.
Yeah. Thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for, I'm so glad we finally made it happen. This has been such a profound and inspiring conversation. I truly mean that. Like, it's given me a lot to think about, and especially at the place I am in my life right now. I think it's helped actually to speak to you. So this is more than a podcast session. This was a genuinely insightful conversation, as they all end up being to a certain extent.
But
thank you for doing this. Where can people find your poetry? Where can people get in touch with you? Let's not forget that.
Yes.
I want the world to experience what you have to offer.
Thank you so much. Yes, you can find me on Instagram. That's what I use. I cannot use multiple social media channels, so I keep myself on Instagram at Namal Siddiqui Poetry.
All right, let's spell out Namal Siddiqui.
NamalSiddiquiPoetry.
That's on Instagram, folks. All right.
Thank you so much for your time. It's all worth it. We've been trying to get in touch for a long time, but it's been wonderful chatting with you and also getting to know you. I actually have a video of you from my JWT days, where we're like, you know, it's one of those chilled out afternoons where we're listening to music. Alex is in that video too, I think.
Of course he is.
You guys are obviously sitting next to each other. And
we're inseparable, yeah. So like
exactly, the back of both of you. We listened to some random song, and I just like made one for my Instagram. And I always come across it every year, you know, when it reminds you of something that you, whatever, like your old posts, Instagram. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think we had those were good times, and we've come a long way. So I'm glad to see everyone where we are.
Man, I was such an entitled asshole back then. But yeah, okay.
How were you?
Yeah, I've come a long way. I know that.
Amazing.
Once again, thank you, Nubbel. We should probably do a round two at some point after you've scaled K2 or like published your first book, perhaps.
Yes.
Whichever.
K2 is like a few years. I mean, if I do end up doing it, it's going to happen in 4 or 5 years, not now.
Yeah. So that should be it. Guys, we are the Localists. I do not remember. It's been so long since I've done this. I do not remember how I usually sign these podcasts off. But if you have any feedback, we'd love to hear it at thelocalistpk@gmail.com. We have a lot of exciting new stuff coming. I apologize for the lack of content recently, but you know, there's some new energy behind this. You can find us on Instagram at thelocalistpk. You can DM us there or leave a comment or like, you know, send us hate mail, whatever you want, man. Honestly, I think I always used to say, don't be a dick. I always used to say, wear your seatbelt, drive safely, because I would appreciate that a lot of people would be driving while doing this, while listening to these. But I'm going to say, don't be a dick. Go get vaccinated this time.
Nice.
So.
And whether you're thanks. Burger or bun kebab, you're all welcome.
This is an inclusive space. We are local wherever we go.
Yep.